Hello, I'm your reader, Natalie Chin, and welcome to the Basin City Globe Gazette issue from Sunday, November 8th. First article is Watch Now, Clear Lake Natives Group Plays at U.S. Capitol Christmas Tree Cutting Ceremony by Ashley Stewart. A Clear Lake Native and her husband provided the soundtrack to the 2020 U.S. Capitol Christmas Tree Cutting Ceremony on Thursday. Carissa and Cy Hoover, I'm so sorry if I'm saying that wrong, it's C-I-E, who comprise Colorado-based indie folk rock duo You Knew Me When, played music from their latest album, Songs of the San Juans, and more at Grand Mesa, Uncompahgre, and Gunnison, or GMUG, National Forest in Colorado. Quote, 2020 has been an interesting year in a lot of ways, so we're doing what we can, and being a part of an event like this gets a little positivity out in the world, Cy Hoover said. The couple, who reside in Ouray, Colorado, were approached to play at the U.S. Capitol tree cutting ceremony earlier this year by people who had seen them perform live in the area. Their latest album is Colorado-inspired and showcases their fondness for their home state. Quote, it was cool being asked, Carissa Hoover said. During COVID, we kept thinking we weren't going to be playing as often, but we feel lucky to have a fan base that's really keeping track of us and still hearing music, unquote. Carissa Hoover, formerly Carissa Doughty, said growing up in Clear Lake, her family always visited Colorado. Quote, it's a fun place to live and be a part of the state and community, Carissa said. I just feel a sense of nostalgia for all the trips I took here when I was younger, unquote. The tree-cutting ceremony and You Knew Me When's performance wasn't open to the public, but it was live-streamed on the GMUG National Forest's Facebook page. The ceremony included brief remarks from U.S. Department of Agriculture Forest Service leadership, local officials, and project partners. You Knew Me When opened and closed the ceremony. Their music, like Colorful Colorado and Ouray, will also be played as the tree tours through Colorado before making its way east. Quote, it's a fun opportunity for us, Cy Hoover said. The tradition of the U.S. Capitol Christmas tree, or the People's Tree, began in 1964 when Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, John W. McCormick, placed a live Christmas tree on the Capitol lawn. This tree lived 3 years before succumbing to wind and root damage. In 1970, the Capitol architect asked the U.S. Forest Service to provide a new Christmas tree, and since then, a different national forest has been chosen each year to provide the tree. This year's tree, a 55-foot tall and 25-foot wide Engelmann spruce, was harvested at the Grand Mesa, Uncompahgre, and Gunnison National Forests in Colorado. Once cut, wrapped, and secured on a trailer, the tree will begin its journey to Washington, D.C. on November 10th. The tree is slated to visit 10 communities for a series of outdoor festivities hosted by local communities. Festivities are free and open to the public for all to enjoy with face coverings and social distancing. Beginning November 10th, the tree's journey can be tracked in real time online at capitaltreetracker.com. Carissa Hoover, who is the vocal music teacher at Ouray School District, said her middle school students are going to sing O Christmas Tree during the stop in Ouray on November 11th. Quote, it's something we could all use right now, she said. An event like this is about togetherness and holiday spirit, unquote. You Knew Me When's three-month East Coast tour was shortened to 3 weeks earlier this year due to the COVID-19 pandemic, but the couple was able to perform at PM Park in Clear Lake. Carissa and Cy Hoover often play in Clear Lake during its 4th of July celebration. To follow You Knew Me When's journey, visit www.youknewmewhen.com or their Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages. Their music can be heard online via Pandora, Spotify, iTunes Music, and other online radio sources. Biden Prevails by Jonathan Lemire, Zeke Miller, and Will Weissert from the Associated Press. Democrat Joe Biden defeated President Donald Trump to become the 46th President of the United States on Saturday and offered himself to the nation as a leader who seeks not to divide but to unify a country gripped by a historic pandemic and a confluence of economic and social turmoil. Quote, I sought this office to restore the soul of America, Biden said in a primetime victory speech not far from his Delaware home, and to make America respected around the world again, and to unite us here at home, unquote. Biden crossed the winning threshold of 270 electoral college votes with a win in Pennsylvania. His victory came after more than 3 days of uncertainty as election officials sorted through a surge of mail-in votes that delayed processing. Trump refused to concede, threatening further legal action on ballot counting, but Biden used his acceptance speech as an olive branch to those who did not vote for him, telling Trump voters that he understood their disappointment, but adding, let's give each other a chance. Quote, it's time to put away the harsh rhetoric. to lower the temperature, to see each other again, to listen to each other again. To make progress, we must stop treating our opponents as our enemy, he said. We are not enemies. We are Americans, unquote. Biden, 77, staked his candidacy less on a distinctive political ideology than on galvanizing a broad coalition of voters around the notion that Trump posed an existential threat to American democracy. The strategy, as well as an appeal to Americans fatigued by Trump's disruptions and wanting return to a more traditional presidency, proved effective and resulted in pivotal victories in Michigan and Wisconsin, as well as Pennsylvania, one-time Democratic bastions that had flipped to Trump in 2016. Biden's victory was a repudiation of Trump's divisive leadership, and the president-elect now inherits a deeply polarized nation, grappling with foundational questions of racial injustice and economic fairness while in the grips of a virus that has killed more than 236,000 Americans and reshaped the norms of everyday life. Kamala Harris made history as the first black woman to become vice president, an achievement that comes as the U.S. faces a reckoning on racial justice. The California senator, who is also the first person of South Asian descent elected to the vice presidency, will become the highest-ranking woman ever to serve in government, 4 years after Trump defeated Hillary Clinton. Harris introduced Biden at their evening victory celebration as a president for all Americans, who would look to bridge a nation riven with partisanship, and she nodded to the historic nature of her ascension to the vice presidency. Quote, dream with ambition, lead with conviction, and see yourselves in a way that others may not simply because they've never seen it before, Harris told Americans. You chose hope and unity, decency, science, and yes, truth. You ushered in a new day for America, unquote. After he spoke, the cars at the drive-in rally, a pandemic campaign invention, began to honk their horns and a fireworks display lit up the night sky. Biden was on track to win the national popular vote by more than 4 million, a margin that could grow as ballots continued to be counted. Nonetheless, Trump was not giving up. Departing from long-standing Democratic tradition and signaling a potentially turbulent transfer of power, he issued a combative statement saying his campaign would take unspecified legal actions. And he followed up with a bombastic all-caps tweet in which he falsely declared, I won the election, got 71 million legal votes. Twitter immediately flagged it as misleading. Trump has pointed to delays in processing the vote in some states to allege with no evidence that there was fraud and to argue that his rival was trying to seize power, an extraordinary charge by a sitting president trying to sow doubt about a bedrock democratic process. Trump is the first incumbent president to lose re-election since Republican George H.W. Bush in 1992. He was golfing at his Virginia country club when he lost the race. He stayed out for hours, stopping to congratulate a bride as he left, and his motorcade returned to the White House to a cacophony of shouts, taunts, and unfriendly hand gestures. In Wilmington, Delaware, near the stage that, until Saturday night, had stood empty since it was erected to celebrate on election night, people cheered and pumped their fists as the news that the presidential race had been called for the state's former senator arrived on their cell phones. On the nearby water, two men in a kayak yelled to a couple paddling in the opposite direction, Joe won! They called it! As people on the shore whooped and hollered. Harris, in workout gear, was shown on video speaking to Biden on the phone, exuberantly telling the president-elect, We did it! Biden was expected to take the stage for a drive-in rally after dark. Across the country, there were parties and prayer. In New York City, spontaneous block parties broke out. People ran out of their buildings, banging on pots. They danced and high-fived with strangers amid honking horns. Among the loudest cheers were those for passing U.S. Postal Service trucks. People streamed into Black Lives Matter Plaza near the White House, near where Trump had ordered the clearing of protesters in June, waving signs and taking cell phone pictures. In Lansing, Michigan, Trump supporters and Black Lives Matter demonstrators filled the Capitol steps. The lyrics to Amazing Grace began to echo through the crowd, and Trump supporters laid their hands on a counter-protester and prayed. Americans showed deep interest in the presidential race. A record 103 million voted earlier this year, opting to avoid waiting in long lines at polling locations during a pandemic. With counting continuing in some states, Biden had already received more than 75 million votes, more than any presidential candidate before him. Trump's refusal to concede has no legal implications, but it could add to the incoming administration's challenge of bringing the country together after a bitter election. Throughout the campaign, Trump repeatedly refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power, arguing without evidence that the election could be marred by fraud. The nation has a long history of presidential candidates peacefully accepting the outcome of elections, dating back to 1800, when John Adams conceded to his rival Thomas Jefferson. It was Biden's native Pennsylvania that put him over the top, the state he invoked throughout the campaign to connect with working-class voters. He also won Nevada on Saturday, pushing his total to 290 Electoral College votes. Biden received congratulations from dozens of world leaders, and his former boss, President Barack Obama, saluted him in a statement, declaring the nation was fortunate that Joe's got what it takes to be president and already carries himself that way. Republicans on Capitol Hill were giving Trump and his campaign space to consider all their legal options. It was a precarious balance for Trump's allies as they try to be supportive of the president and avoid risking further fallout, but face the reality of the vote count. On Saturday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had not yet made any public statements, either congratulating Biden or joining Trump's complaints. But retiring GOP Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who is close to McConnell, said, quote, "After counting every valid vote and allowing courts to resolve disputes, it is important to respect and promptly accept the results," unquote. Trump defied gravity, but future is to be decided, by Jill Colvin and Zeke Miller. Donald Trump, who defied political gravity with his extraordinary rise from reality star and businessman to the presidency, has fallen back to earth. In the end, his flurry of raucous rallies, an unprecedented turnout operation, and sheer force of will could not overcome the reality of his enduring unpopularity and a raging pandemic that has killed more than 236,000 people in the U.S. and thrown millions out of work. Yet Trump's acerbic brand of politics, his Twitter taunts, his vindictive drive to punish enemies, his go-it-alone approach to the world, made its mark across the far reaches of the government and beyond. And his better-than-expected election performance against Democrat Joe Biden suggests his impact is likely to resonate for generations in politics, governing, and policy, even in defeat. It remains to be seen that what Trump intends to do after his term ends on January 20th. Retreat to the golf course? Launch his own television network? Lay the groundwork to run again? And how fiercely will he try to contest his fate? Quote, "I would absolutely expect the president to stay involved in politics. I would absolutely put him on the short list of people who are likely to run in 2024, Trump's former chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, said in an online interview with the Institute of International and European Affairs. He doesn't like losing, unquote. Trump retains the megaphone of his Twitter account, a far-reaching Fox News platform, and the unflinching backing of his loyal base of supporters, who may never accept his defeat after he spent months insisting there was no way he could legitimately lose and even falsely claimed premature victory. On Saturday, Trump declined to concede to President-elect Biden, instead promising unspecified legal challenges to try to overturn the outcome of the race. Until a successor emerges to lead Republicans, likely not until the resolution of the 2024 Republican primary, Trump remains the de facto head of the party that he has reshaped in his image. Quote, "Even in defeat, Donald Trump has exceeded expectations and helped other Republicans to do the same," said GOP consultant Michael Steele, who has worked on Capitol Hill and for campaigns. "He will remain a powerful force within the party," unquote. Still, Trump's loss is likely to spark a reckoning over how much of Trumpism the party should embrace going forward, especially given that Republicans could retain control of the Senate and won additional seats in the House. Had Biden won in a blowout, that would have put wind at the back of a lot of Republicans who said character counts and the Republican Party should never put its faith into someone who pushed boundaries like Donald Trump, said former White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer, who served under former President George W. Bush. But because it was closer, he predicted the party would likely continue to be racked with a split between insiders and outsiders, between the establishment and the Trump supporters who fought the establishment. And the soon-to-be former president's role will be a huge question mark because if he decides to stay active, despite the close loss, he remains powerful and effective, especially for Republicans. And that was all a quote. In the meantime, it remains unclear whether Trump will accept the results of the election as he expends the next 3 months as a lame duck president. Those who know him well say there is little chance he will go quietly into the night. Quote, "When Donald Trump loses, there will never be a peaceful transition to power," said Trump's longtime lawyer and fixer-turned-critic Michael Cohen. He predicted Trump would do everything in his power to claim the election was stolen from him by Democrats or other forces, just as Trump tried to sow discord as the votes were being counted. Cohen said Trump was also likely aware that after losing the presidency, he might be served with a plethora of lawsuits, both federal and state. Trump is already facing lawsuits that accuse him of sexual assault and defamation, and his Trump Organization's finances are being investigated by New York's Attorney General. Barbara Ress, a longtime Trump associate who recently wrote a book about her experience working with him, speculated the president might leave the country before Biden's inauguration and perhaps pursue his own media empire. Quote, "He could put on whatever he wants. He could say whatever he wants. It's almost like having Twitter explode into everything else," she said. Regardless of what he does, Douglas Brinkley, a professor of history at Rice University, said Trump would likely go down as an aberration in U.S. political history. Quote, "One-term presidents are rare. There's a great advantage to being an incumbent, and Trump squandered it," he said, arguing that Trump would likely be seen as an insurgent figure, even though 25% of the American public will always see Donald Trump as their Rambo and John Wayne figure combined, unquote. As for the future for Republicans, Steele said the party would likely look to leaders who combine elements of Trump's populist agenda with policies that appeal to a broader swath of the electorate. Quote, "The challenge will be identifying the popular, durable, and practical parts of his agenda and marrying them to policies and arguments that appeal to the broader electorate that the party will need to win at the national level in the future," he said. Clear Lake Middle School holds presidential election by Ashley Stewart. Clear Lake Middle School students learned firsthand how the U.S. Electoral College system works in electing the president Tuesday. That's thanks to 8th graders Bergen Klein and Owen Smith, who created the school's own election between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. Quote, "We designed the election to represent how the Electoral College works, and we were also curious how our middle school would vote," Klein said. The school's Electoral College comprised of 300 electors to represent 342 students. To determine the number of electoral votes of each homeroom, Klein and Smith used the average number of students in each grade. Homerooms with more students than the average got less votes, and homerooms with less students than the average received an extra vote. In 6th, 7th, and 8th grades, there were 6 homerooms, including one category in each grade for online students. Based on Klein and Smith's system, Trump won the middle school with 240 electoral votes, while Biden received 60. Trump also received the school's popular vote, with 62.9%. Quote, "One of my goals of creating this poll was to show the students how the Electoral College works, why we have it, and why some people think it is a bad system," Klein said. Today in History from the Associated Press. Today is Sunday, November 8th, the 313th day of 2020. There are 53 days left in the year. On November 8th, 2016, Republican Donald Trump was elected America's 45th president, defeating Democrat Hillary Clinton in an astonishing victory for a celebrity businessman and political novice. Republicans kept their majorities in the Senate and House. In 1793, the Louvre began admitting the public, even though the French Museum had been officially open since August. In 1861, during the Civil War, the USS San Jacinto intercepted a British mail steamer, the Trent, and detained a pair of Confederate diplomats who were en route to Europe to seek support for the Southern cause. Although the Trent affair strained relations between the United States and Britain, the matter was quietly resolved with the release of the diplomats the following January. In 1864, President Abraham Lincoln won re-election as he defeated Democratic challenger George B. McClellan. In 1923, Adolf Hitler launched his first attempt at seizing power in Germany with a failed coup in Munich that came to be known as the Beer Hall Putsch. In 1950, during the Korean War, the first jet plane battle took place as U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Russell J. Brown shot down a North Korean MiG-15. In 1960, Massachusetts Senator John F. Kennedy defeated Vice President Richard M. Nixon for the presidency. In 1966, Edward W. Brooke, a Republican from Massachusetts, became the first black candidate to be elected to the U.S. Senate by popular vote. President Lyndon B. Johnson signed a measure allowing the merger of the American Football League and the National Football League. In 1974, a federal judge in Cleveland dismissed charges against 8 Ohio National Guardsmen accused of violating the civil rights of students who were killed or wounded in the 1970 Kent State shootings. In 1987, 11 people were killed when an Irish Republican Army bomb exploded as crowds gathered in Enniskillen, Northern Ireland, for a ceremony honoring Britain's war dead. In 2000, a statewide recount began in Florida, which emerged as critical in deciding the winner of the 2000 presidential election. Earlier that day, Vice President Al Gore had telephoned Texas Governor George W. Bush to concede, but called back about an hour later to retract his concession. In 2002, the UN Security Council unanimously approved Resolution 1441, aimed at forcing Saddam Hussein to disarm or face serious consequences. President George W. Bush said the new resolution presented the Iraqi regime with a final test. In 2017, director Ridley Scott decided to cut Kevin Spacey out of the already completed movie All the Money in the World because of the sexual misconduct allegations against Spacey and reshoot his many scenes using Christopher Plummer just 6 weeks ahead of the film's release date. 10 years ago, on the third and final day of his trip to India, President Barack Obama endorsed the country's bid to become a permanent member of the UN Security Council. Former kidnap victim Elizabeth Smart took the stand in Salt Lake City on the first day of testimony in the trial of Brian David Mitchell, the man accused of abducting her in June 2002 when she was 14. Talk show host Conan O'Brien made his debut on TBS. 5 years ago, Myanmar's ruling Union Solidarity and Development Party lost by a landslide in a general election to the National League for Democracy of Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi. In his first public comments on the latest scandal rocking the Vatican, Pope Francis told followers in St. Peter's Square the theft of documents describing financial malfeasance inside the Holy See was a crime, but pledged to continue reforms of its administration. An acoustic guitar that John Lennon used to record and write Love Me Do, I Want to Hold Your Hand, and other hit songs sold for $2.4 million at auction in Beverly Hills, California. 1 year ago, Facebook said it was deleting the name of the person who had been identified in conservative circles as the whistleblower who triggered an impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. The death of a Hong Kong University student who fell from a parking garage during clashes between police and anti-government demonstrators fueled more outrage against authorities. Former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who'd been imprisoned for corruption, was released after the country's Supreme Court ruled that a person could only be imprisoned after all appeals had been exhausted. U.S. health officials said they had a very strong culprit in the outbreak of vaping illnesses, finding that the same chemical compound, vitamin E acetate, was found in fluid taken from the lungs of 29 patients across the country. Mason City High School musicians named All-State from the Globe Gazette. 19 students from Mason City High School have attained the highest individual honor available to Iowa high school musicians by being selected as a 2020 All-State musician. While the 2020 All-State Music Festival concert has been canceled due to health safety concerns caused by the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, that in no way diminishes the accomplishment of the young musicians designated as members of the 2020 All-State Band, Choir, or Orchestra, organizers said. The MCHS chorus qualified 17 students for participation. Natalie Angel, soprano. Grant Bowles, tenor. Ava Chevarelli, alto. Jackson Everest, bass. Janaya Everest, alto. Nathan Farland, tenor. Emma Garrett, alto. Gretchen Garrett, soprano. Maggie Garrietz, alto. Kylie Hansen, soprano. McKenna Hansen, soprano. Jack Hardy, tenor. Avery Heinzerling, alto. Gabby Johnson, alto. Aiden Stroop, tenor. Owen Stroop, bass. Samuel Swagel, bass. The MCHS band qualified 2 students for participation. Britta Elsbernd, oboe. Trevor Torkelson, tuba. Adopt a Senior for Christmas through Elderbridge Agency by J.C. Smith. Elderbridge Agency on Aging and North Iowa Community Action Organization have partnered for Santa for Seniors. Each senior who is looking to be adopted will request their needs and wants, which will include their favorite color and sizes. This information will be used when purchasing a gift. Due to confidentiality, names cannot be disclosed. However, Elderbridge Agency on Aging and North Iowa Community Action Organization will ensure that the specific senior and sponsor are matched. If you would like to adopt a senior or multiple seniors, please contact Lori Brandt from North Iowa Community Action Organization at 641-423-7766 extension 11 or by email lbrandt@nicao-online.org and let her know you'd like to adopt a senior. Gifts should be wrapped and ready to go when they are dropped off to North Iowa Community Action Organization. Attention to Lori Brandt, 101st Street Northwest, Suite 140, Mason City, Iowa, zip code 50401. Drop-off times are 9 a.m. to 4:20 p.m., December 14th, and 8 a.m. to noon, December 15th. Santa's helpers will be wearing masks and delivering the gifts to the doors of the seniors adopted. And excuse me, let me repeat that email here. L. Brandt, it's L, B as in boy, R, A as in apple, N as in Nancy, D as in dog, T as in Thomas, at N as in Nancy, I, C, A as in apple, o-online.org for that charity. Shop Iowa information coming to Mason City, Forest City, from the Globe Gazette staff. Iowa's brick and mortar retail businesses can now set up an online shop through shopiowa.com. Shop Iowa is funded by the Iowa Economic Development Authority, enabling small retailers to sell their products, up to 25, for free through June 30, 2021. If you are a small brick-and-mortar retail business in Iowa, have products you can ship, and can receive online orders, you qualify. During Global Entrepreneurship Week on November 16th and 17th, the IASBDC Mobile will be in Charles City, Forest City, and Mason City to help small business owners set up their Shop Iowa storefronts by taking photos of products and walking through the storefront creation process. Limited one-hour appointments are available. Contact the NIACC Papa John Center and SBDC at papajohn@niacc.edu for more information. Enrollment in Obamacare underway, from the Globe Gazette staff. Open enrollment for Marketplace Health Insurance, available through the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, has begun and runs through December 15th. Financial help is available when signing up for health insurance through the Marketplace. Last year, 8 in 10 applicants qualified for financial help in obtaining health care coverage. Those with current Marketplace coverage should pick a new plan or re-enroll in their existing plan by December 15th to prevent a lapse in coverage. Anyone in Iowa can call 515-978-9570 to reserve a telephone appointment. Consultations are available over the telephone or through a telehealth option, which will allow callers to see their application completed in real time. There is no charge for enrollment assistance. The agency is a free program to Iowa residents and receives federal funding to assist consumers with enrolling in Medicaid or in private health insurance through provisions of the Affordable Care Act. More information is available at www.acanavigator.com. Just the beginning. Several key steps remain to formally elect the president. Saturday's election verdict isn't the last step in selecting an American president. Under a system that's been tweaked over two centuries, there is still a weeks-long timeline during which the 538-member Electoral College picks the president. Here's how it works. The Electoral College is the body that elects the president and vice president. Citizens cast their ballot for a ticket that includes a president and a vice president, but the voters are actually voting for electors, who make up the Electoral College, which then casts the votes for a candidate. Those electors, in most cases, are committed to support the voter's candidate of choice. State laws vary on how electors are selected, but generally, a slate of electors for each party's candidate is chosen at state party conventions or by a vote of a party's central committee. Each state is entitled to a number of electors equal to that state's representation in Congress. Each state gets two senators and a number of House of Representative members. The total number of senators and representatives would be the number of electors each state receives. Most states are on a winner-take-all basis. There are a couple of states, Nebraska and Maine, that reward electoral votes in proportional representation. 51% or more of the votes are needed for the candidate to win all of the state's electors. Electors are added up. A simple majority of 270 is needed to win the election. Finally, on the Monday following the second Wednesday of December, the electors meet in their capitals and cast their official votes. Now moving to Simply Healthy with Stephanie, ditch the crust but keep the flavor. This quiche is waistline friendly but equally as tasty. November is National Diabetes Month. Diabetes is a disease that is well known but not often well understood. Many people assume that the nutritional management of diabetes involves just limiting sugar, but this is not the case. A variety of nutrients impact the health of a person with diabetes. Though an individual with diabetes must monitor multiple nutrients, nutritional management of diabetes did not have to be hard. Understanding carbohydrates. The first nutrient that a person diagnosed with diabetes should understand is carbohydrates. All carbohydrates, whether complex, chains of sugars connected to each other, or simple, individual sugars, will impact blood sugar. Complex carbohydrates take longer to digest and thus have a blunted impact on blood sugar levels when compared to simple sugars. Fiber-containing carbohydrates are the slowest to digest, and choosing high-fiber sources of carbohydrate is crucial to keep blood sugar under control. It is not necessary for individuals with diabetes to eliminate carbohydrates. Rather, they should focus on consuming high-fiber carbohydrates and avoid consuming large amounts at any one time. Monitoring fat intake. Monitoring fat intake is another important component of diabetes management. Individuals with diabetes are at an increased risk of heart disease, and following a heart-healthy diet is essential. Increasing intake of unsaturated fats, such as those found in nuts and seafood, while limiting saturated fats, such as those found in processed foods and animal products, will help promote heart health. High-fiber foods, in addition to helping control blood sugar, also help control cholesterol levels, simultaneously promoting both heart and diabetes health. Finally, decreasing sodium intake is also important to help control blood pressure and support heart health. Meal planning and dietary changes. Despite all of these guidelines, meal planning for individuals with diabetes does not have to be complicated. Half of the meal or plate should be filled with non-starchy vegetables. Any vegetables besides corn, peas, potatoes, and winter squash. Vegetables provide fiber with minimal carbohydrates or calories, helping to stay full with little to no impact on blood sugar. A quarter of the plate should be a high-fiber carbohydrate. Included in the carbohydrate section are potatoes, corn, peas, or winter squash, grains such as pastas, rice, or breads, and fruits. The remaining quarter of the plate should be a lean protein. Chicken, fish, turkey, or lean cuts of beef or pork would go here, as well as non-meat protein sources such as cheese, tofu, nuts, or seeds. Following this basic guideline helps make meal planning straightforward for anyone, diabetes or not. Making dietary changes to help control diabetes does not have to mean giving up favorite foods. Most all foods can be consumed in appropriate amounts. Many recipes can also be modified to decrease carbohydrate intake or improve the fat or sodium content. And now the recipe here, get your pens and papers ready. Crustless slab quiche, serves 8. All you need, a 6 ounces thinly sliced pancetta, may substitute low sodium bacon or smoked ham slices. 8 Hy-Vee large eggs. 2 cups of Hy-Vee half and half. 1 1/4 cups of Hy-Vee 2% reduced fat milk. 1/2 teaspoon of ground white pepper. 1/4 teaspoon of Hy-Vee salt. 1/4 teaspoon of Hy-Vee stone ground Dijon mustard. 2 1/2 cups of Hy-Vee shredded Italian blend or mozzarella cheese. 2 tablespoons of Hy-Vee all-purpose flour. 2 cups of fresh baby spinach, loosely packed and divided. 1/3 cup chopped fresh basil, loosely packed. 1 cup halved grape tomatoes. All you do. Preheat the oven to 325 degrees. Spray a 12 by 10 by 1 inch sheet pan or 13 by 9 by 2 inch baking dish with nonstick spray. Set aside. Cook pancetta in a large skillet over medium heat until crisp. Coarsely chop half the pancetta. Set remaining pancetta aside. Whisk together eggs, half and half, milk, pepper, salt, and mustard in a large bowl. Combine cheese and flour in a medium bowl. Toss until flour coats cheese. Add cheese mixture, chopped pancetta, 1 cup of spinach and basil to egg mixture. Combine well. Pour egg mixture into prepared pan. Tear reserved pancetta into large pieces. Top quiche with remaining spinach, pancetta, and tomatoes. Bake 30 to 40 minutes or until a knife inserted near center comes out clean, 160 degrees. Let stand 10 minutes before serving. Free diabetes shopping assistance. Join Stephanie for an individual nutrition shopping tour to learn about how carbohydrates affect your blood sugar. Stephanie will point out diabetic-friendly foods that taste great and help keep you healthy, especially during the holidays. Register at Hy-Vee.com or email Stephanie at snorris@Hy-Vee.com for more information. Don't feel comfortable shopping in the store? We can do a virtual shopping tour as well. All right, we're about halfway here. Just a reminder that you are listening to the Sunday, November 8th edition of the Mason City Globe Gazette. It's time to move to obituaries. Jacqueline J. Erdman, age 87, of Northwood, passed away Tuesday, November 3rd at the Lutheran Retirement Home with her family at her side. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, November 14th at Sunset Rest Cemetery in Northwood with Reverend Corey Allard of Trinity United Methodist Church in Boland, officiating. Visitation and public viewing will be from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Friday, November 13th at Connor Colonial Chapel. which is located 1008 First Avenue, South Northwood, Iowa. The family suggests memorials be made to either Trinity United Methodist Church in Bolin or to the Lutheran Retirement Home. Jacqueline, or JC, Jean Carlson Erdman, was born to Arthur, Art, Carlson, and Viola, or Bobby, maiden name Kennison, Carlson, on April 30, 1933, in Barton Township at the home built in 1891 on the Byron Kennison Farm, her great-grandfather and one of the first settlers in that area. She was baptized at an early age at the Evangelical United Brethren Church of Bolin, where she remained a member throughout her life. She attended grade school at Barton No. 2 Country School and was a 1951 graduate of Kensett High School, participating in choral music, school plays, and basketball. After high school, she went to LeJames Beauty College in Mason City, graduating in 1952. She later worked as a beautician at the Beauty Nook in Northwood, becoming owner of the business, being there for 37 years. She was united in marriage to Howard Erdman on August 24, 1952, and they raised their two children, Pamela and Craig, in Northwood. JC enjoyed many activities throughout her life, including school sporting events and concerts. She and Howard were a fixture on the bench at NK basketball games for many decades. She enjoyed bowling league, her cirrhosis study club, and the annual Kensett Variety Show. She served in many capacities in the church: Sunday school teacher and superintendent, Bible school teacher, financial secretary, member of the United Methodist Women, and lifelong member of the choir. She enjoyed embroidery, cooking, coffee with friends, and her flower garden, and did her best to follow the school activities of her children and grandchildren. The past 3 years, she has traveled to Mason City for kidney dialysis at Fresenius Care and has been a resident of the Lutheran Retirement Home in Northwood for the past 2 years, both places where she made new friends. She is survived by her two children, Pam, partner Don Anderson of Northwood, and Craig, partner Joni Erdman of Manassas, Virginia. Six grandchildren, Audra, partner Amit Varma, Matt Anderson, Grace Erdman, Elizabeth, partner James Burnett, Hope Erdman, and Curtis Erdman. Three great-grandsons, Alex and Charlie Burnett, and Ishan Varma. Two brothers-in-law, Phil Erdman and Roger, partner June Erdman. Nephews Kevin, partner Lisa Carlson, and John, partner Sandy Kraft. Lauren, partner Paula Erdman, and Arlen, partner Deb Erdman, and nieces Carrie, partner Carlson, Kirk Stoa, and maiden name Erdman, partner Roger Ryerson, Uncle Donnie, partner Darlene Kennison, along with many cousins. She was preceded in death by her husband Howard, her parents Art and Bobby Carlson, her brother Daryl Carlson, her niece Kim, maiden name Carlson Kraft, her grandparents Axel and Mia Carlson, and Roy and Althea Kennison, Howard's parents, Erwin and Irene Erdman, sister-in-law Ruth Erdman, and uncles and aunts, Everett Carlson, Arnie Carlson, Walt Carlson, Hazel Trainer, Pearl Marnholtz, Dorothy Perkins, Harold Kennison, Dorothy Kennison, Margie Baskett, and Marvel Carr. Carla Jean Kohler. Carla Jean Kohler, age 63, died Sunday, April 12th at her home. Visitation will be held Wednesday, November 11th from 4 until 6 p.m. at the Major Erickson Funeral Home. Due to COVID-19, masks will be required. A memorial mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, November 12th at the Epiphany Parish St. Joseph Catholic Church, following the COVID-19 practices set forth by the church, with Reverend Josh Link officiating. Interment will follow in Park Cemetery, Nora Springs. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.MajorErickSonFuneralHome.com. Carla was born December 5th, 1956, in Mason City, Iowa, the daughter of John and Barbara, maiden name Frudenberg, Rep. Carla attended and graduated from Mason City High School in the class of 1975. On September 9th, 1978, she was united in marriage to John Kohler. To this union, three boys were born. Carla loved being outdoors. Her summers were kept busy with family activities, tending to her flowers, taking long walks and playing with the dogs. She also enjoyed relaxing boat rides up and down the Mississippi River. Carla loved being her grandma, and family always came first. She looked forward to following her children and grandchildren in their many activities and events. She was a people person and loved the company of her many friends. Those thankful for having shared in Carla's life include her husband, John, sons Adam, partner Beth Kohler, Kyle, partner Ashley Kohler, Joel, partner Christy Kohler, one brother, Mark, partner Pat Rep, nine grandchildren, Colton, Hank, Gabe, Callan, Adeline, Clayton, Auden, Haley, Hadley, Landry, mother-in-law Elizabeth Kohler, and several nieces and nephews. Carla was preceded in death by her parents, John and Barbara Rep, and father-in-law, Lawrence Kohler. Arrangements are with Major Erickson Funeral Home and Crematory, located in Mason City. Robert G. Thomas. Robert G., or Bob, Thomas, age 65 of Brookfield, formerly of Mason City, was a U.S. Navy veteran. Visitation will be held on Wednesday, October 28th, from 3 to 8 p.m. at Kretko Nosik Funeral Home, located in North Riverside, Illinois. Funeral service was 3 p.m., with military honors at 7 p.m. Cremation was private. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations to the American Heart Association would be appreciated. Virginia A. Rees, age 83 of Britt, passed away Thursday, November 5th at Westview Care Center in Britt. A private family funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. on Monday, November 9th at the United Methodist Church in Britt, with Reverend Robert Dodge officiating. Burial will be at Bingham Township Cemetery in Woden. A public visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. on Monday, November 9th at the United Methodist Church in Britt. Masks are encouraged and social distancing guidelines will be followed. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be given to the donor's charity of choice. Cataldo Funeral Home in Britt is in charge of arrangements. Virginia Ann Fries, the daughter of Albert and Anna, maiden name Reekin Green, was born on June 6, 1937 in Algona. She attended Bingham No. 7 Country School and graduated from Woden High School in 1955. She continued her education at Waldorf College in Forest City. After college, Virginia worked at Majan Motors in Britt. On December 29, 1956, she was married to Gerald Vries at the Evangelical Free Church in Britt. They lived and farmed near Woden all of their married life. After Gerald passed away in 1998, she continued to live on the farm southeast of Woden until moving into Britt in 2008. She enjoyed spending time with her family, crafts, and tending to her flowers. She was a member of the United Methodist Church in Britt and a former member of the Woden Christian Reformed Church, where she taught Sunday and Bible school. Virginia belonged to a quilting group in Britt, sang in the Sweet Adeline's choir, and in her younger years was active in 4-H. Virginia is survived by her three children, Leanne, partner Keith Lamack of Britt, Marcia, partner Bruce Kluver of Britt, and Leroy, partner Diane Rees of Britt. Seven grandchildren, Brett, partner Heather Kluver, Amber, partner Brandon Heimer, Jennifer, partner Andy Vask, Jolene, partner Brock Balling, Jill, partner Daryl Nixt, Ben Vries and Billy Vries, eight great-grandchildren, Madeline and Lily Borg, Aubrey and Braxton Kluver and Kaylin, Kenley, Kia, and Colton Balling, three step-great-grandchildren, Nolan Jackson and Preston Vask, a brother-in-law, Calvin, partner Lorene Vries, a sister-in-law, Sharon Vries, and several cousins. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband, Gerald, November 23, 1998, parents-in-law, Clarence and Anna Vries, brother-in-law Kenny Vries, and aunts, uncles, and cousins. Emily A. Moore, age 87, passed away on November 4th at the Sanford USD Medical Center in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Emily Agnes Moore was born on December 25th, 1932, at Clarkson, Nebraska, to Frank Sr. and Antonia, maiden named Jindra, Cerny. She was raised in Nebraska, attending high school and then entering the Nebraska State Teachers College at Wayne. After college, Emily was a teacher in a country school in rural Nebraska. On June 23, 1954, she was united in marriage to Marvin Mark Moore at Clarkson, Nebraska. After marrying, Emily left teaching to become a full-time mother to her five children. As the children grew older, Emily re-entered the workforce, holding various positions until choosing to become the editor of the Beresford Republic of Beresford, South Dakota, and the Elkton Record of Elkton, South Dakota. Emily enjoyed her role, since she was able to meet new people and have unique experiences. For nearly 40 years, Emily was known as the Avon Lady. Avon soon became Emily's passion, as she continued to sell while the family moved throughout the Midwest. Her joy originated from visiting homes and enjoying a cup of coffee with her customers. Upon retirement, Emily and her husband would travel visiting their children and friends across the U.S. She enjoyed playing bridge and golf, was a longtime member of Gamma Omega Chapter of Beta Sigma Phi and various community organizations, and the Arizona Sunshine. Grateful for having shared her life are her brother, Frank, partner Patty of Decatur, Illinois, 5 children, Deborah, partner Kenneth Becky of El Paso, Texas, Michael, partner Jackie Spearfish of South Dakota, Kevin, partner Beth of Sioux Falls, and Teresa, a special friend, Kevin Frazier, of Glendale, California, 10 grandchildren, Hillary, Abby, Joe, Jeffrey, Thomas, Ashley, Brigham, Tyler, Kayla, Ashley, and Anthony, and 3 great-granddaughters, Sophia, Palmer, and Tilly Joe. She was preceded in death by her parents, loving husband Marvin, son Terry, and his sister Adeline. Celebration of life will be held at a later date to be determined. Condolences may be sent to Teresa Moore at 1043 Winchester Avenue, Apartment 11 of Glendale, California, zip code 91201. In lieu of flowers, family requests donations be made to the Alzheimer's Association in Emily's name. Heritage Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements and can be reached at www.heritagesfsd.com. Bert Tekip, Jr., 80th birthday. He celebrated his 80th birthday last week. His family is hosting a card shower to mark the occasion. Cards and greetings may be sent to Bert at 56 Circle Terrace at Mason City. Much love from your wife, children, and grandchildren. Happy 60th birthday. Please help us wish this special guy a happy 60th birthday. Cards may be sent to 1108 South 11th Court of Clear Lake, Iowa, zip code 50428. Love, your wife, kids, and grandkids. And apologies for Bert Tekip Jr. The full address is 556 Circle Terrace, Mason City, Iowa, zip code 50401. And a thank you. Many thanks and hugs for the beautiful cards I received for my birthday celebration. What a lovely trip down memory lane to hear from all who have touched my life in so many ways. Thank you, Mary E. Montgomery. Another thank you. Thank you for the cards and gifts I received for my 101st birthday from Pearl Barkema. Thank you for all your encouraging words, comforting cards, phone calls, thoughts, and prayers during Mom's struggle with Parkinson's and her recent death on October 9th. Family of Rava Pedelti, Rachel, Jean, Vernon, and families. Rogers, 50th anniversary. Bob and Phyllis, maiden named Jensen Rogers of Mason City, were married November 15, 1970 at the United Methodist Church in Anita, Iowa. They have 2 daughters, Sarah, partner Randy Nuring, and Amy, partner Nate Umura. 8 grandchildren, Jalen, Sydney, and Alex Nuring, Blake and Olivia Baskerville, Sydney, Haley, and Ryan Umura. They will be celebrating with their children at a private party. Their family is also requesting a card shower in honor of their parents' 50th anniversary. Cards of congratulations can be sent to 419 19th Street, Southwest, Mason City, Iowa, zip code 50401. Camper, Noon Rotary Student of the Month. Ashton Camper was chosen as the Noon Rotary Club's Student of the Month for November 2020. Camper is a senior at Mason City High School. She is the daughter of Scott and Chris Camper and sister of Kendra Camper. Ashton Camper is a member of Mason City Concert Choir and plays violin in the Mason City High School Orchestra. This is her second year as the principal violinist in the ensemble, and she is also the president of the orchestra. Camper has lettered in volleyball and played all 4 years of high school. She is also a member of Trinity Lutheran Church. Camper participates in Silver Cord, is a member of National Honor Society, and is on honor roll. Next year, she plans to attend Wartburg College in the pre-dental program with a major in biology. Cool, 50 years. Marianne Hoffman and Larry Cool were united in marriage on November 7, 1970, at Holy Family Catholic Church in Mason City, Iowa. They are celebrating their 50th anniversary with their sons, Daryl and Doug, and families, with a trip to Duluth, Minnesota. Betty Graverson, age 90. Betty Les Graverson will celebrate her 90th birthday on November 16th. In lieu of a party, help Betty celebrate by sending cards to 275 North Taft Avenue, number 206, from Mason City, Iowa, zip code 50401. Michigan couple with 14 sons welcome first daughter. A Michigan couple whose large family attracted attention by growing to include 14 sons has welcomed their first daughter nearly 3 decades after the birth of their first child. Kateri Schwant gave birth Thursday to Maggie Jane, who weighed in at 7 pounds 8 ounces, and entered a world filled with 14 older brothers. Jay Schwant said he and his wife, both 45, are overjoyed and beyond excited to add Maggie Jane to our family. Quote, "This year has been memorable in so many ways, for so many reasons, but Maggie is the greatest gift we could ever imagine. he told the Detroit Free Press following his daughter's birth at Mercy Health St. Mary's Hospital in Grand Rapids. The Schwants have been featured for years in local and national news as their family has grown. The couple have a live streaming program called 14 Outdoorsmen that may now need a name change. Their oldest child, Tyler Schwant, 28, said his parents thought they would never have a daughter after 14 sons. He said there's likely nothing pink in the family's home in the rural community of Lakeview, about 30 miles northeast of Grand Rapids. Quote, "I don't even know if my mom owns any pink clothing or anything," said Tyler, who is engaged to be married and recently bought a home 20 minutes away from his parents' 200-acre farm. The Schwants started dating as freshmen, attending Gaylord High School and Gaylord St. Mary's, respectively. They wed in 1993, before they attended Ferris State University, and before they graduated, the couple had three sons. Both earned advanced degrees, even as their family grew. Kateri holds a master's degree in social work from Grand Valley State University, and Jay, who is a lawyer and owner of a land surveying business, holds a law degree from Western Michigan University's Thomas M. Cooley Law School. Running short on time here, folks, I'll see if I can move through a couple of opinion articles here. Skipper, "I want that hometown jam on a Friday night feeling back." From John Skipper. Let's just admit it, the presidential election and the long campaigns that preceded it brought out the worst in us. We're not only seriously divided, but we have no qualms about showing the whole world how mean we can be to one another. Folks, we've lost that love and feeling. The question becomes, how do we get it back? In previous columns, I referred to a book written by U.S. Senator Ben Sasse, a Nebraska Republican who was reelected Tuesday night. The book is entitled Them, Why We Hate Each Other and How to Heal. In it, he laments about the divisiveness in the United States and, like many of us, wishes we could learn to get along a little better. The ideal atmosphere, according to Sasse, would be that hometown gym on a Friday night feeling, borrowing a phrase he admits came from a Sports Illustrated article he read. "I've thought a lot about the hometown gym on a Friday night feeling, a place where people from all walks of life come together for a basketball game or a band concert, many times celebrating the talents and skills of young people. There are doctors and lawyers, teachers and custodians, housewives and career women, people of color, rich and poor, and yes, Republicans and Democrats, all enjoying each other's company and cheering for each other's kids. That's the kind of world I want to live in. That's the kind of country I want to live in. That's the kind of city I want to live in. But it has to start at the top. We need leaders who encourage us, inspire us, and motivate us. As a nation, we deserve that from the president and from Congress. As a community, we deserve that from our civic leaders. When something like the pandemic hits, we need leadership that tells us we're all in the same boat, grab an oar. Many presidents have done that in the past. President John F. Kennedy, in his inaugural address, encouraged us by saying, ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. President Ronald Reagan told us that his dream for the country was to be a shining city upon a hill. President George H.W. Bush, in accepting the Republican nomination in 1988, saw America's potential as 1,000 points of light. They are all really talking about the same thing, that hometown gym on a Friday night thing. We are fortunate in North Iowa to have enthusiastic leaders. In Clear Lake, City Administrator Scott Flory and Mayor Nelson Crabb lead the cheers that embrace the community in one project after another. In Mason City, Roger Bang, a four-term councilman and one-term mayor, had an inclusive attitude, even with those he disagreed with, saying, everyone is well-intentioned. Current Mayor Bill Schickel says his philosophy in building community support is to concentrate on addition and multiplication instead of subtraction and division. As a nation, I think we long for that hometown gym on a Friday night feeling, but it starts at the top. Won't be able to finish this next article, but let's see what we can get through. What exactly is China buying on its U.S. shopping spree? By Alan Gubert. As political winners joust over election spoils, many Americans are tickled pink, or purple, to leave the costliest, most bitter campaign season behind and return to their lives of family, work, and dreams. For U.S. farmers and ranchers, that means a return to three pre-election realities: a strong export-led rise in grain prices, another winter of choppy livestock markets, and China's growing impact on all U.S. ag markets. In fact, China's swift recovery from the viral pandemic it spawned is now the key driver in world ag markets. The International Monetary Fund pegs China's 2020 economic growth at 2%, tiny compared to its decades of ferocious growth, but far ahead of the U.S. economy that is forecast to shrink 4%. Equally impressive is how the newly revved up China is spending its profits. Its consumers are doing what the rest of the world used to do, eating better, traveling more, and buying more consumer goods. And all this after China's economy shrank 6.8% in the first quarter, its first fallback in almost 50 years, according to the New York Times, because of the coronavirus and its sledgehammer reaction to it. But that red sledgehammer, Comrade, also made way for China's current purchase of U.S. farm and food exports. According to Bloomberg News, China already has purchased more than 10 million metric tons of U.S. corn in the 2020-2021 marketing year, or about 2.5 MMTs more than all of last year. Moreover, it's still buying. Some forecasters believe China will buy a record 17 MMTs, or about 780 million bushels of corn in 2020-2021. If accurate, it will buy all the corn grown this year in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Oklahoma combined. The same trend can be seen in its purchases of U.S. soybeans, pork, and beef. All are off to record starts this marketing year as the world's only healthy major economy continues its grocery shopping spree. But is it that simple? Is China just sopping up relatively cheap, unsold global food supplies to restock its COVID-depleted pantry, or is there a deeper, less apparent reason for the buying binge? Yes and yes, argue several longtime trade analysts. For example, in an October 30th blog post, Daniel Eikenson, a trade expert at the Libertarian Cato Institute, argues that President Donald Trump's and U.S. farmers' much-cherished Phase 1 trade deal with China, the rocket fuel for some of the buying, is a bilateral folly that discriminates against our democratic allies like Japan and Canada. As such, he argues, Phase 1 undermines U.S. leadership for any future multilateral effort to contain China's more sinister international ambitions. Echoes of Eikenson's argument can be heard in a November 3rd Bloomberg News story that wondered if President Trump's shift away from Republican free trade orthodoxy hasn't just been a very loud civics lesson in the misguided economics of protectionism and the costs of tariffs and economic nationalism. Yes, it has, but good luck trying to convince American farmers and ranchers who have received billions in tariff mitigation money under the Trump policy, and now, mostly due to China, are enjoying the first major rise to farm prices in years. It's hard to argue with them before or after November 3rd, when Red Rural America again voted for the administration's tariffs and economic nationalism policy, with, as the Trump White House often notes, Red China. Still, warns another trade analyst during an Election Day telephone call, never forget that China is, by far, the shrewdest player in the export game. You never see its whole hand until the game is over. Wise words. China might be your best customer now, but it will never be your best friend. And that's it for the Sunday, November 8th edition of the Mason City Globe Gazette. I've been your reader, Natalie Chin. Have a great day.